talking to part three of the short series looking at Wales's opponents at Euro 2020 or Euro 2021. If you prefer, we've looked at Switzerland and Turkey already, and now we turn our attention to Italy. Well, you're one of the giants of the game, clearly. We've played them before, nine times, beaten them twice, and lost all of the others, and pretty heavily on most of those occasions, actually.
Four is against us. They've scored four occasions. They've put four past us,
Started in 1965 in Florence, where they beat us 4-1. And looking at the lineup, I mean, there's not many caps in their lineup at all. So I can only assume that they were taking a fairly experimental approach to that game. In front of 43,000, Brian Godfrey scores our consolation in the 80th minute. You've still got, so this is 1965, you've still got Ivor Allchurch. We talked about him facing Switzerland in 51. So, 17 year international career. If Jones is inside, then it's just a lot of sort of youngsters, really. Well, Roy Vernon's there, 20 caps. Mike England, 14 caps. So, not a huge amount of experience. And by the looks of it, it told.
And then we had them in the qualifying for the 1970 World Cup, and they went all the way to the final, so it shows you they were a decent team at that time. And just look at this game at Ninian Park, 1968. Beams off in goal, Riviera, really good players, and they beat us 1-0 at home. We weren't a particularly good team in the 60s, we just really didn't do much in that whole sort of decade. And then we went away for the return leg and lost 4-1. Mike England scored our goal. Luigi Riva scored a hat-trick in that game.
Yeah,
that was a good Italy team.
And went on to the final at 70. Gigi Riva played pretty much all, a couple of seasons when he first came onto the scene as a teenager in Italy for a different club. But he played all of his career for Cagliari, and there's a local Italian-owned coffee shop by me in Llandaff North in Cardiff by the name of Coffee Rex, which I thoroughly recommend. Andrea is from Sardinia and who owns it, and big Cagliari fan. Every now and again, I get the special Cagliari cup and saucer, which is, this means a lot to me because I do then stress that I might break it, but I do say don't ever give it to me when I've got the kids around. Although at least that would give me the excuse to say that they did it. But anyway, so he's a big Cagliari fan, and Gigi Riva is his hero. And he said he used to serve him an awful lot. He would be on the piazzas, very, very private. And it's one of the reasons why he never went to any of the top Italian clubs or European clubs. And there was offer after offer after offer because he was one of the top strikers of his generation. World strikers, not just European strikers. He was just happy in Sardinia. And how Andrea talks about Sardinia, albeit as a Sardinian, he talks about it particularly then, it's a backwater. People look down on people from Sardinia. And I know another Italian guy who sort of said, Sardinians, given that Italians, I suppose, have that reputation, the Italian language is very, it's a very quick language to speak and to hear. He said they have a phrase, people on the mainland have a phrase of Sardinians, while they talk, you can make cheese. They take so long to say anything that you can make cheese in that process. The milk will curdle and all the rest of that. I remember mentioning this to Andrea and he sort of made some derogatory comment back about mainlanders, basically. But what's interesting is, I don't know what the equivalent of it is, but it's Wayne Rooney leaving Everton, not for Manchester United, but for Southampton and being happy on the South Coast for the rest of his life, or signing for Middlesbrough and being happy on Teesside. And it just suited him, and he just kept scoring goals. And pretty sure as well, I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure he settled there. He stayed there then for the rest of his life, which I just think that's lovely. But Andrea just worships this guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, so there's my about the only thing I know about Gigi Riva. Available on Wikipedia.
Go to Wikipedia. There's a great photo in there. Just looking so Italian. 35 goals in 42 caps. It's a pretty decent strike rate, isn't it?
Which, according
to this, makes him Italy's all-time leading scorer still, which is extraordinary. Yeah. amazing strike rate he has, but that nobody since has got more than 35 goals for Italy. Seems a little bit surprising considering how many great strikers they've had over the years. But that just kind of shows like what a fantastic player he was, you know.
And of the countries sort of considered Europe's finest, biggest, best, you know, whatever, being the longest traditions in the game, I'm pretty sure that is the goal scoring record that has been in place the longest then for a country, if that makes sense. So, for example, you know, Germany was, yeah, is, you know, is closer.
Yeah, yeah.
Portugal's is Ronaldo. It's Rooney for England.
The offers, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. So Italy's is goes back some way. I mean, even for the likes of us, then, you know, it's a current player. That tends to be the norm. But for Italy, no, it's he's still there. But
he is. You know, I'm looking at the list now. His last cap was in 1974. So there you go. Mm. I mean, since his last cap, the person who's got nearest is Roberto Baggio and Alessandro Del Piero both scored 27 goals. So they were still, you know, 8 goals off his record. And so those are two legends there. And looking also who else got maybe close, Filippo Inzaghi, we'll be talking about him in a minute, got 25. Yeah. And Christian Vieri got 23 goals, as did Francesco Graziani. Well, still out there is Italy's leading.
And according to Wiki, his final cap came at the age of 29 as well. So, you know, probably would have scored a lot more. But his Wiki pick, that's one of the best Wiki pictures around, isn't it?
I mean, it's just a beautiful kit. Yeah. That kit in its simplicity is just
really. Absolutely. Well. It's a lot different to Clayton Blackmore's Wiki picture. Let's just put it that way.
I'll go on there later.
The next time we play them, though, is in a friendly in Brescia, just before Euro 88, and which obviously we've qualified for. And we rock up with Tony Norman in goal, Gareth Hall is playing, Geraint Williams, Barry Horn's fifth cap. There's Rushness Hughes, admittedly, Pat Vandenhuyzen in the team. It's not a vintage Wales lineup, though, let's be perfectly honest about it. Glyn Hodges, Mark Hazelwood gets his 10th cap, the late Alan Davis, and we managed to beat them. Probably one of the sweetest goals Rush scored in his career, surely.
Yeah. That was the end of his... right.
And he was captain for the day as well.
The end of his season in Italy, wasn't it? When he was quite heavily criticised. Juventus didn't have a great season and he got a lot of criticism for not scoring at the rate that he did at Liverpool. But we've talked about this before. It was an ultra-defensive, very kind of slow style of football at the time in Italy. I think Maradona was the top scorer that season for Napoli with something like 14 goals. So just people didn't score a lot of goals. There were a lot of 1-0s, a lot of 0-0s. Well, he struggled, let's be fair, but his record wasn't as bad as it was made out. It was just that in comparison to the rate of goals he was scoring at Liverpool, it was nothing. He struggled to adapt in that sense. So he would have he enjoyed that, having been sort of criticised by the Italian press. But, I mean, yeah, you look at our lineup. It's aside from up front where Rushing Hughes is, you know, one of the best strike partnerships in the world at the time, there's no comparison with this Italian lineup because you've got Walter Zenger in goal, Franco Baresi, Paolo Maldini, Carlo Ancelotti, Roberto Donadoni, Roberto Mancini, Gianluca Vialli. So a lot of people who went on to be managers in England. The sheer quality in terms of the players that they had available. And it looked like pretty much a full strength lineup to me, warming up for Euro 88. So fair play. That is a fantastic result to beat them.
And two interesting observations of this, which I hadn't picked up on before, and I've looked at this page any number of times when you've been doing research about different things, is that there were more Juventus players in our starting lineup than theirs. And Italy had two warm-ups for Euro 88, Luxembourg away and Wales at home, which doesn't strike me as they're not the sort of opposition that are going to give you a little bit of a test, battle-hardened going into the tournament. It seems a strange, rather lukewarm choice of opposition, but I don't know, because then the very next match after us is then, drawing 1-1 with West Germany, who were hosts, obviously, in 88, you know, in the tournament itself. So, yeah. We'd beat Malta 3-2 the game before.
Terry Urif was sort of on a sort of trial period at this time, and this result kind of got him the job. It was set in stone that he was going to get the job, I'm pretty sure. So that Ian Rush goal, that really got him the job, because you can't really turn down a manager who gets you a win against Italy away, can you?
No.
It's significant in that, even though it was a friendly, it was significant in that respect, in that, you know, that was the beginning of the Terry Urif era and successes and near misses that we would go on to enjoy over the next few years.
Yeah. Hughes was at Bayern for that game. And the next time we play them is in 1996 under Bobby Gould. And, well, there you go. Has there ever been such a tactical managerial mismatch in Bobby Gould versus Errigo Sacchi? Blimey. Anyway, we get beat 3-0 in Terni. Del Piero, Ravanelli and Pierluigi Casiraghi do the damage.
Yeah, our lineup again. I mean, it's just, okay, 8 years earlier we'd managed to sneak a win, but there's a huge gulf in quality there, you know. Where it's a friendly, it's Bobby Gould. Par, isn't it, in golfing terms, you know, you'd give them a 3-goal start, wouldn't you, looking at those two lineups. And I guess they were preparing for Euro 96 and we weren't. So I remember nothing about this match, but it's probably for the best.
Bobby Gould gave Marcus Browning his debut. Bobby Gould had also been the manager of Bristol Rovers when he signed Marcus Browning as a kid as well, which is something I learned in the a Crysau Cochion book, the Welsh language book, which is like a player sort of almanac, which again is a terrific book for nuggets of information. Marcus Browning also faced the Netherlands, which is remarkable as well in many respects. The only real significance, I suppose, of this game is that it was Ian Rush's final cap. And much the same way that Gould then later hauled Neville Southall off in fairly inauspicious circumstances, ignominious, one might even say, he did the same with Rush, pulled him off in 63 minutes, sent on Gareth Taylor, and Rush never played again.
No, so it's 1996 was final caps for... No, wait a minute, 96-97, this is the era where it's sort of coming to a close for that sort of Rush and Southall generation, isn't it?
I
was saying goodbye to these players now.
Not a huge amount of time left for Mark Hughes either. 16-year international career for Rush, which is, you know, good going.
Yeah, I think he was brought into the squad for the first time for Mike England's first game against England at the racecourse, but didn't play, I'm pretty sure. Having just gone to Liverpool not long before. Yeah. Mark Hughes was still there when we play Italy next in 1998 at Anfield.
Yes, which I went to. And I can remember gigs getting a hugely hard time from fans. It's one of my memories. I had admittedly been drinking very heavily, so I don't remember a huge amount about the game. I remember Coleman's mistake. Yeah. He'd obviously been overshadowed by the whole Robbie Savage, Maldini shirt affair. Just other examples of just the random chaos that just seemed to follow us around under Gould.
I don't remember that. I remember him playing really well in the first half. I remember starting really well. Giggs hit the bar with a free kick. Blake nearly got in on goal. Blake played really well as well. Andy Johnson, his debut, we talked about him before. Mm. He was getting on the ball quite a lot. It wasn't too bad. It was sort of like competitive opening stages, and then Coleman, I think he was not long back from injury, and he sort of seemed to be kind of feeling his way back at that point, and he just sort of lost concentration and just like gifted the ball to Diego Fuser, who slid it home, and it was just like, you can't just gift a team that's that good, that talented, a goal like that. And they were always sort of kind of more in control after that. Oh, we gave a pretty good account of ourselves, and it was, you know, fairly late on when Christian Vieri scored to make it safe for them. 77 minutes, we'd been competitive to them, but they were, you know, they were better than us. Yeah, it was a, you know, once that second goal went in, the crowd turned on Gould big time. I was on the cop. It was pretty vicious Bobby Hunts for the rest of the game, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, a team as good as that, but a team as well drilled, to not concede.
The second goal showed the team that he had as well. It was a really good move. They just moved the ball so quickly and they don't know what they're doing. And you just can't gift them goals like we did. But we just, you know, it was just how we were at the time. In the 90s, we were just gifting goals to position like for years and years.
Yeah.
We kind of had to, it was just like this terrible habit that we got into, and we sort of had to kind of sort that out, really. And fair play to Hughes, he did, that was the kind of almost like the first thing that he just sorted out when he became manager, was just like, we've got to stop conceding stupid goals. And that's what happened. We drew a lot of games when he first took over, competitive games, before we started to add a bit of icing on the cake by sort of winning. And we'll come to the most famous Hughes victory very soon, I'm sure.
So the return fixture in that Euro 2000 qualifying is in Bologna, and I suppose for as chaotic as lots of other episodes in Gould's reign were or had been, there was still time for some even more chaotic scenes, which I've heard a version of this from somebody who was in the ground and was involved with the FA at the time, and it is every bit as ridiculous as it sounds. Completely lost the players in the dressing room at halftime. Giggs and Speed and Hughes, big personalities. You've got, you know, Hearts and Saunders. Hearts is still a youngster at that time, but you know, Andy Melville's got a lot of caps. And basically said, you know, enough is enough, because they've gone in at halftime 3-0 down. Even Paolo Maldini has scored, and he never scored. Vieri and Inzaghi have scored. Again, Inzaghi filled his boots against us. And basically, Gould knocks it on the head at half-time, is the version I heard. And we lose the second half 1-0. And it's not until the 89th minute that we ship another one. So we performed better without him officially, technically in charge, and quite significantly better than we did with him in charge, which perhaps says a lot.
It's funny, I've just pulled up this game on 11vs11.com under the name of the team. It says the manager, and for Italy, it's manager Dino Zoff. Wales manager Neville Southall. is that on purpose? I don't know. Because Southall was the one who took over for the second half. But yeah, officially, this was Bobby Gould's game as Wales manager. Perhaps a suitable ending in some ways.
I think the simple thing was we couldn't afford to sack him. And so it was waiting for him to either fall or waiting for him to on his own sword or to wait to the end of the contract. And unfortunately, he went a bit before the end of the contract. But we were basically stuck with him because of finances and the logic of the game. And if you've been given the contract, you sign it, then you're entitled to what is contained within it. So not criticising Bobby Gould in that regard, but what a parlous, desperate situation to be in, where you've got an absolute clown in charge. But I'm mindful that we want to keep a little bit back, don't we, for the Gould years?
Maybe we should. Yeah. This is in Bologna in June, so it's very hot. And one of the Italian players, I really can't remember who, but was interviewed before the game. And I think the question was something like, why should people bother to come and watch this game? And usually, you know, football will sort of hand out sort of some platitudes and say, oh, well, it's a step on our development, and we're really looking to kind of push on now for the tournament next year or something. Whoever it was, it might have been Buffon actually, the keeper. He said, if I was thinking of going to this game, I just wouldn't bother. I'd go to the beach instead. They knew that they were coming up against just a poor team in chaos, and it was just going to be a bit of a nothing match, which it kind of, you know, it turned out to be for them. And more significant in that it got rid of Bobby Gould and sort of brought in a new era of Mark Hughes being manager. And like I said before, at least he made us hard to beat for a while. And then we sort of entered 2002 still kind of drawing a few games, like Czech Republic had a good draw with them at home, and we managed to beat Italy in that summer just before they went to the World Cup. And then we beat Finland away at the start of Euro 2004 qualifying. I mean, it was a fantastic occasion of playing Italy at the Millennium Stadium.
To give you an impression of how low-key they perhaps considered us as opposition, it was played in Bologna, as you say, and that was Italy's first game there in a decade, and it was their first qualifier since 1962. So, you know, they were taking a qualifier to more or less a complete backwater in footballing terms for them. In fact, the previous international it hosted was one of Bosnia's first games. They weren't able to play home. And before that, it was the famous San Marino 1, England 7 game. Bologna.
Why didn't England play that game in Rimini in San Marino, though?
San Marino fancied the chances.
Take it to a bigger venue.
And for about 12 seconds, they were right. Yeah. Where do we start? I mean, what hasn't been said about the win in Cardiff in 2002? Just, you know, one of my all-time favourite atmospheres in a game, any stadium, and thoroughly deserved to win. So it starts with the Mannix playing beforehand, and we score really. Hartson bullies one of the all-time great centre-back partnerships in Nesta and Cannavaro. Well over 100 caps between the two of them. Gives them a torrid time. You know, you've got Buffon in goal. Del Piero scores a lucky goal. It's just one of my all-time favourite. Gattuso goes on, he comes off.
Okay, yeah.
He's absolutely furious.
Yeah.
which I loved. Yeah, one of my all-time favourites. Memories.
Will live
long. And not just because I've also got it on VHS. I think it's probably the last VHS I ever
bought. It's the one that I haven't been able to part with. All the others went to sort of charity shops and stuff years ago. I've still got it on my bookshelf, Bellissimo, it's called, isn't it? I'm buying it at Cobb Records in Bangor, which sadly no longer exists. Just to go back to that centre-back partnership, Cannavaro alone won 136 caps. So I don't know how many Nesta got, but, you know, World Cup winning captain there. Buffon in goal, 176 caps. Pirlo, 116 caps.
Nuts.
Okay, it was an early game for him. He just sort of come onto the scene at that time, but it was a quality Italian team. You know, there are a couple of players missing, but Italy's a huge nation and they can bring in quality. You know, they had the Vieri and Inzaghi out, but could still play Del Piero and Montella up front. Montella had just won the league with Roma and was their top scorer when they won the league. So that's not a bad replacement, is it? And we went, you know, toe-to-toe and just we were superb. It was just a brilliant night, one of the best nights watching Wales I've ever had. Yeah, what more can you say? But it was that good that it deserves to be talked about a lot.
Yeah, to answer your question, Nesta won only a paltry 78 caps.
Right.
Compared to those other names. Massimo Macaroni played as well. It was a second of only two caps.
Just for contrast.
Yeah, and again, not that this matters in any sense, but again, it's a nice little curio of that. All starting 11, and then Nathan Blake as a late substitute for Bellamy was born in Wales. Can't imagine that's happened a huge number of times.
I'm pretty sure that's the last time that we've actually had every player who played was born in Wales. I'm pretty sure.
Well, I remember putting it out on the Twitter when the game was reshown on BBC, and, you know, not least because, you know, people like Sam Vokes and Ashley Williams have got so many caps over the last few years. But not making any other comment or judgment
it's just curio, isn't it? I mean, looking at the next game we played against Italy, I'm pretty sure the starting lineup, everyone was born in Wales, but then Earnshaw was born in Zambia, and Andy Johnson came on, who was born in Bristol. So that was maybe not the last time that every player in the starting line was born in Wales, but pretty sure it's the last time that every player who played over the course of the 90 minutes was born in Wales, something like that.
I mean, the Milan game is significant because it's probably the first away game for a significant number of fans, me included. It was quite a sour evening, I suppose, in the end. I just remember being impressed by the San Siro and that stadium that caught my imagination at Italia 90. And, you know, it's about to be pulled down, I understand. And it wasn't at its finest by this point in 2003 by any means. But that sense of awe, because, you know, English clubs have been banned from Europe. You know, the rest of the clubs that were competing in Europe from the UK weren't clearly doing a great deal. And so we didn't have the internet, we didn't have YouTube, we didn't get, you know, cable and all these other kind of channels available. So European football was still quite exotic, other than the times that, you know, we went out to play there or they came to play us. And then suddenly, you know, Euro 88 to a certain extent, but you know, Serie A was still, you know, the principal European league. And the stadia just looked otherworldly, certainly to my sort of formative impressionable age of about, what was I, in 1990 World Cup, like 13 and a half. And so something like the San Siro was still up there in my thoughts, my memories as one of the great stadia. I guess by this point, a lot have moved on, not least perhaps the Millennium Stadium have moved on, and the design and the, I'm trying to say, it's that kind of sense of awe that these structures can invest in you had evolved greatly. So I just remember coming up the stairs to the San Siro thinking, wow, this is a stadium. We did okay in the first half. We had to put Simon Davis at right back, didn't we? So for all of the success under Hughes, you begin to realise it was that the pool of players was still very, very small. So Delaney comes across at centre half and they just buff away second half, don't they? It's basically 20 minutes, if that, 15, 20 minutes. They score all the goals. Inzaghi, what was it Ferguson famously said? He was born offside. And he barely moved and scored a hat-trick in, I think it's, according to this, 11 minutes.
Yeah, we were struggling a bit when he had a couple of players missing through injuries and they were kind of in the mood to give us a bit of shout some revenge for that defeat. I didn't go to this game, but San Siro, I was lucky enough to be there in 2010 when Bale scored a hat-trick. So I have sort of happier memories of being there than most Wales fans, actually, from that game, because it sounds awful, just like the stories of where the fans were treated and people pouring stuff over the Wales fans.
It wasn't great. I mean, I have fond memories of the whole trip because we stayed out in Bergamo, so we were a little bit outside of Milan itself. There were a lot of Murtha fans in Bergamo because of course, the Atalanta links. And Bergamo was just enchanting. I just adored it. And just very, very fond memories of it all. Although, having said that, I have no memory of about 6 o'clock on the Sunday the following day. No idea. Just a complete blackout. And so Bergamo was also the venue of probably my worst ever hangover. I'd have happily just stayed in the hotel room and just paid whatever I'd had to pay to stay in that hotel room for longer and get a new flight and get back from London. I mean, at that, I was so ill. Griff Rees came up to me to speak to me randomly, and I was so ill I could barely reply. You know, one of my musical heroes, and I could barely.
Have you met him since? Was that the only time?
I used to bump into him on the school run every now and again, but still too embarrassed. it's not as sophisticated or as funny as your mate Andy's encounter with Barry Hill. At least I didn't have skiing gloves on. That's about the only thing I can say about it in my defence.
Saving grace there, yeah.
I started drinking Campari, and I've never touched it since. We found an Irish bar and just got very, very messy. And because we weren't flying home, so the game was a Saturday, we weren't flying home till early the Monday morning. So yeah, no, very messy. But nevertheless, very, very fun. And Bergamo was lovely that Sunday morning, just kind of chilling in the piazzas, watching them all go to church and just looking immaculate, you know, men and women of any age. Very lovely. And the weather was nice and incredibly picturesque. And I think it was really at that point that I actually realised that that's where Atalanta are based. Right. And there's an old bit to it and a newer bit. I mean, not all of it's amazing, clearly, but it's up on this hill. It's, yeah, very, very nice.
Well, to bring it back to going to Italy. I mean, I'm due to be going to Rome. That was going to be a trip that me and my friend Dave were going to do, and there's a few of us, the other two Welsh lads that I know here. Yeah, it's a shame, obviously, it can't happen now, and, you know, the border between Italy and Austria is still closed at the moment. It'll probably be the last one to open. They've just, I think, opened the borders with Slovenia and the Czech Republic. The one with Germany has been open a couple of weeks now, and Switzerland as well. But Italy, because of the very high infection rate down there, it's going to be a bit slower. But mega looking forward to another a trip down to Italy to watch football again. But it'll have to be, next year now. La 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 la
watching.